No. La la la, say it again.
We're on the record. If you can look after that for me.
Huh?
We're on the record now.
Okay.
Good. Okay, Miss, where you go?
Bradley.
Keep a good eye on.
I've got a backup one here. Just one there. It's running at the same time.
Bradley.
Just in case that one comes, I've got a backup.
Well, my name is Amos, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Amos.
This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad you're all here. Thank you. If anybody's got a mobile phone, could you just ask them to put on to silent and switch it on? Thank you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you. Hi everyone, I'm Pat, an alcoholic.
Patrick.
And I'm going to read more about alcoholism, chapter 3 of the big book. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterised by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led at times to pitfall and incomprehensible demoralisation. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone is showing the inability to control his drinking, can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without solemn oaths, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitments to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. Thanks everyone. As I say, my name is Pat, an alcoholic.
Pat.
It's nice to be here tonight. Just before I introduce our first speaker, I met our first speaker in Akron City Hospital last July for the first time, and what an awesome retreat it was to be at. That was where Bill Dodson, AA number 3, was 12 steps, and we had a retreat there, and it was absolutely stunning. So with no further ado, I'll introduce tonight's first speaker, and that's Tina.
Now I feel at home. My name's Tina, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tina.
And I'm really grateful to be here and to be sober tonight, and welcome if anybody's new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is October 10th, 1984. I have 24 years and 11 months, and I am absolutely in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Patrick was talking about when we met last year in Akron, and it was the first time that I had ever been to Akron. I'm from California, and I had heard a lot about Akron. I love the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so we went back there to do a little workshop and a retreat, and oh my goodness, I would sit still for a minute when nobody was around and nobody was talking and just get goosebumps staring up at the windows trying to figure out, like, which room might they have been in. And I am in awe of Alcoholics Anonymous. From the time that I got sober to now, I just absolutely love this deal. And it's a great honor and privilege to be asked to come over here and speak with you guys this evening. Patrick, thanks. And Hamish, thanks for all your hospitality. I've had so much fun. We flew in Tuesday. And oh my goodness, we've had a blast. We went up and saw Stirling Castle and took lots of pictures, and today we were up at Loch Lomond. I guess it's like a 30-minute drive, but Patrick took us the long way. So it took about 2.5 hours to get up there because we have no idea where we were, and I didn't anyway. And everybody was tired of the ride, but I was amazed by your countryside, and it's just been phenomenal. I'm so happy to be over here. It's beautiful. I was thinking, as I was growing up, my father was from England, and so my grandparents lived in England and Canada back and forth. And I loved my granny and my Grampy Gill, and my dad had that strong English accent, so I listened to Patrick, and I think about my father, and he was really proper and very educated, and then my mother is from West Virginia, so I have proper educated English father and backwoods Appalachian Hills hick mother, and then here I am trying to figure out, like, am I proper and educated in English or am I backwoods hillbilly? And I have felt conflicted from the very time that I could remember, and I can't tell you why I felt conflicted. I was just ill at ease, like my skin didn't fit. There was just something a little bit wrong, and I could never figure out what it was. When I was a little girl, my babysitter used to take me to a Roman Catholic church. So I would do the Roman Catholic calisthenics up and down and up and down, and I had no idea what we were doing. And then my best friend would take me to a Protestant church, and then we'd go over to a all-inclusive, non-denominational thing where they were hallelujahing and praising and speaking in tongues and singing. And I guess hereditarily, I'm a German Jew. So I got the Catholic and the Protestant, the non-denominational and the Jewish. And then left to my own devices, I like to go hang out in Native American sweat lodges. So I'm just like the epitome of a contradiction. And I can never, ever find a place where I feel like I fit in. And long before I picked up a drink, that was a problem for me. And I was raised in this little beach community in Southern California where everybody was 5 foot tall, all the girls, teeny tiny, 5 foot tall, long blonde hair, really, really tan with blue eyes. And they were just beautiful. I don't know if you guys have that show Baywatch over here with Pamela Anderson, but they were all like little prepubescent Pamela Andersons running around just perfect. And I was 5 foot eight, and I had long, stringy red hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And I would walk out the door during a full moon and get a third-degree burn. I mean, every time I was in the sun, I just burnt. And I would look at these little girls and think they were absolutely perfect. And then I looked in the mirror, and I felt like a cross between Raggedy Ann and Pippi Longstocking. I just was wrong. I didn't fit in my own skin, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And we went to middle school. And they started having us change into PE gear. And we were in the locker room one day, and I'm looking at these little girls in their perfect designer clothes and their little lacy training bras. And mine fit better when I put it on backwards. I was just... There was something something incredibly wrong with me. And one day I ditched school. I went to my best friend Carrie's house and we dove into a bottle of her mom's scotch. Oh my goodness, I love that. We were lost today out in the countryside and we saw scotch tasting tours. And I was thinking, oh my God, I'm 25 years too late. I would have had fun over here. And in California, they do those Napa wine tasting tours. And I was never much into wine with grapes in it, so I skipped that. But that was pretty neat, that distillery. And so I went to my friend Carrie's house and we started drinking scotch. And we took a whole fifth of her mom's scotch. We cracked the seal. We threw away the cap and we started drinking the scotch. And I put a drink in my mouth and oh my God, I absolutely hated the taste of it. I swore to God I was not drinking any more of that. It burnt all the way down to my toes. Then all the way back up until it flew out my nose. It was the most putrid, horrific, vile stuff I had ever put in my mouth. And I watched Carrie take a couple more drinks and all of a sudden she was giggling and her face got a little pink and she wasn't worried about ditching school anymore. We were like 13 in the 7th grade and I just knew I wanted what she had. And so I started drinking that scotch and I took a couple drinks and I threw up all over her living room. And there were large gaps in my memory that afternoon as we were running all over Manhattan Beach. And I couldn't tell you what we were doing other than what I heard. I know we were running from the police and they were not chasing us, but we were running from them anyway. And we were hiding in backyards and doghouses and climbing over fences and climbing the water tower. And we had the grandest adventure I had ever had. I had so much fun. And what I found out quickly was that I got, like Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion, a sense of ease and comfort at once when I took a couple drinks of alcohol. And I didn't know that until I came to you guys. I knew that I loved what booze did for me. And I kept drinking for the rest of that day, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I realized I couldn't go home because I was in a major amount of trouble. And I stole a bike and I took a 9-year-old who was Carrie's little brother and I ran away from home because it just seemed like a good idea. And I ended up in East LA about 11 o'clock at night with a crying 9-year-old on the handlebars. I would imagine it was something like that little neighborhood that we drove past on the way in here. It was a little scary. And I had a great idea that for the first and only time in my life, I'd call the police on myself and they would come pick us up, and they did. And my mom got us and she was just devastated. She was crying and I felt horrible. And in the morning, somebody needed to explain to me why I shouldn't do that every single day for the rest of my life, because I got something so profound in that drink of alcohol that I didn't care what I did. I didn't care what it cost me. I didn't care who I hurt. I just wanted to drink some more. And I drank my way into and out of middle school and high school and continuation school. I drank myself into and out of the United States Navy. Long before I got sober, I had 3 great loves in my life, and they were Jack Daniel's whiskey, Jose Cuervo tequila, and United States Navy sailors. And so I figured I could get lots of those if I enlisted. It worked. And I went off to boot camp. I got drunk in boot camp and I got in trouble. I got drunk in A school and I got in trouble. And I was drunk all the time, getting in trouble. And they recruited me to be in a naval intelligence in the Navy. And so I'm getting busted and standing in front of my commanding officer, absent without leave and drunk on duty and doing all kinds of bizarre stuff. And I was just always in trouble behind a drink of alcohol. And they sent me to Adak, Alaska, where I was secretary to my commanding officer. And I got a little bit of rank and I made it through school. And I loved my job. I loved the prestige that came from being secretary to the commanding officer of my security group where I was stationed. And I used to iron my uniforms until the creases on the sleeve would just cut you. And I looked good in my uniform. There was nothing like that sense of pride that came as a result of serving my country. And I loved it. And after a little while, I couldn't show up to work quite on time. And I would leave at lunch and come back, and my tongue would be a little thick, if you know what I mean. And I couldn't speak properly because I had had a couple drinks on my lunch break. And then I started calling in sick and going to the sick hall. And I was drinking drinking all the time in trouble, and they ended up putting me on Anabuse while I was stationed there. And do you guys have Anabuse over here?
Yeah.
Charming stuff, I swear. And they put me on Anabuse, and I decided one day after a couple weeks I would try to drink on it. And I got through half of a Heineken, and I got so sick I swore to God I was going to die. And then I was afraid I wasn't. And I just threw up for hours, and I went to the counseling office the following day with big blotches all over my face and tried to convince him that I had the chicken pox. And he knew what was wrong. He knew I had drank the day before. And so they left me on Anabuse. They were sending me to counseling, and all the while they were trying to get me to look at the way that I drank and what was going on around a drink of alcohol. And I wasn't willing to look at it. And I spent a couple weeks in a psychiatric unit in Anchorage because I drank on Anabuse. The Navy considers that grave emotional and mental disorders for some reason. And so they sent me to the psych unit, and not long after that to a rehabilitation program. When I met Wayne, I had been I'm like a big book thumper, like you wouldn't believe. He used to joke and say, if you cut me, my blood would be blue, because I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love to beat people up with it in my home group. But I'll talk about that in a minute. But they sent me to this rehab, and when I met Wayne, I had swore that I had never gone through treatment, because a lot of the language that I would use didn't sound like Alcoholics Anonymous, but it sounded kind of treatment-ish, which is a little bit different than our language. And so he asked me, have you ever been through treatment? And I was like, oh, heck no. And the truth of the matter is, I was in the Naval Treatment Program in Philadelphia in 1981, and I didn't think I had been to treatment because I didn't make it through treatment. And I drank on Anabuse and treatment, and I ended up getting kicked out and discharged from the military, and I was absolutely mortified. July of 1983, I got out of that rehab, and I swore with every fiber of my being that I was not going to drink anymore. Booze had begun to decimate all the things that mattered to me in my life, and I swore I wasn't drinking. I had one of those firm resolutions like Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion in our big book, and oh my goodness, I was going to go to that neighborhood Alano Club at that noon meeting. I was going to ask this horrific witch named Alice to sponsor me, because I figured you needed one of those. And so I was going to go, and I was going to do the deal, and I was going to beg to save my military career. I didn't want kicked out. I was going to do whatever it took. And I left that rehab, and as I was leaving the hospital to go over to the naval station, I saw my counselor down by the front door waiting for me. He was this little old man, and he was probably, I don't know, at the time, maybe 25 or 30 years sober. He was just, he got sober with Moses, I swear. And he was standing by the door, and he looked at me as I was walking out. He told me, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous. But you won't, you'll die drunk. And I was 19 years old, and I figured, like, old man, what are you talking about? Like, you just don't get it. And coincidentally, I think it's so funny, like, what a small world we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Wayne went through that same treatment program 15 years before I did, and he had this phenomenal old-timer counselor who maybe had about 10 years at the time. His name was Jim Boyer, and he was the same one as I had. And he was a great guy, and I went over to that naval station swearing I wasn't going to drink, and by noon I was at the enlisted club, and I was pitching quarters, and I was drinking beer for the fourth time on Anabuse. Didn't go any better that time than it did any of the others, and I was discharged from the military. I was mortified. I didn't want kicked out of the Navy, and I spent, when I got out of the Navy and you guys told me that I was an alcoholic, I sounded something like, I can't be an alcoholic because I'm only 19 years old, and then I turn 20. And I can't be an alcoholic because I'm too young. I haven't lost a job. I don't know what I thought a military career was, but it wasn't a job. So I haven't lost a job, and I haven't been divorced. I haven't destroyed any children. I haven't lost my family. I've never been homeless. I've not gone to jail. I've never had a drunk driving. I just came up with all of these reasons why I couldn't be an alcoholic. And over the course of that 16 months, I did every single thing that I used to separate me from you. And I found myself in October of 1984, living in a great RV down by the beach. And after I got sober, I realized that RV was a 1971 MG Midget. And I had a trunk in the trunk with all my stinky, dirty clothes and all my worldly possessions. And I lived in my car. And in a small, little, tiny area, I drove from the Pitcher House to the Hermosa Saloon to the gas station where I parked the car, and then back to the Pitcher House in the morning when they woke up. And I just went in a circle, like about a 3-mile circle. And I did nothing. And by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no relationships left in my life. I had robbed my mom's house about a year previously, and she kicked me out and told me never to come back. And I had destroyed all the friendships that I had with people that I had before and after I got out of the service. And I was just living in that car, and I was drinking. And I believed that I was an alcoholic. Had anybody told me, I would have had no problems telling you that I was an alcoholic. I did not, however, know what that meant. I thought by this time I was an alcoholic because I'd gotten a drunk driving, because I'd now been to L.A. County Jail. I was having blackouts all the time, and they told me that was one of those little warning signs that if you have complete memory lapses as a result of your drinking, that you might be alcoholic. And I thought I was alcoholic because I was homeless, because I had no relationships left. All the reasons that I wasn't, I now believed I was. And what I found out after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is none of that outside stuff is what makes me an alcoholic. It's definitely a clue, but it's not what like gets me to know that I'm an alcoholic. And I came in here and I got one of those sponsor things you guys told me to get, and that's how I learned what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, on the 9th day of October in 1984, I was sitting in my den, which was the driver's seat, and I had a bottle of vodka that I had just stolen from Boys Market on the seat next to me, and I hadn't opened it yet. Patrick and I were talking before the meeting about like the sense of ease and comfort we get at once by taking a few drinks, and I had that vodka sitting there with the seal not broken, and I knew it was there, and I could relax. Like, I know this is here, and I'm okay. And I had that bottle sitting there, and I swear to God, just like he was sitting in the seat next to me, I heard Jim Boyer tell me, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't, you'll die drunk. And I got out of the car, and I picked up a payphone. I put a dime in the payphone, and I called central office. I said just what he told me to. My name's Tina, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm looking for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I actually put on my best I'm okay voice, because I'm pretty good at fooling you. And so I told him I was an alcoholic. I was looking for a meeting, and this little old man named Sam covered up the mouthpiece of the phone, and he told Eunice, who was our central office manager, we got a live one here. Let's send her over to Birch. And they sent me to this little Alano club in Hawthorne, California, where, oh my God, I walked in there. There were about 70 people at a 5:30 meeting, and they all ranged in age between like 92 and 180. And I figured like this was my penance for drinking like a pig, and I was going to have to live the rest of my miserable, pathetic life in that little room with all those old people. And oh my goodness, I couldn't have ended up in a better group for me. And the funny thing is my entire life I felt different, like I didn't fit in and I didn't belong and I wasn't good enough and I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't smart enough. No matter what I did, I never measured up, and I was full of this fear that I couldn't explain to you what it was. It wasn't a fear of spiders or the dark or losing a job. I had this fear in here that there was something wrong, and I couldn't figure out what it was, that you were going to know what it was before I was, and then you were going to have something on me. And I walked into this club, I could not have been any more different from those people than if I'd have walked into a meeting in our White House. I swear to God, I could not have been more different. And I went in and I sat on the very front of that meeting, and I started copying the steps down on a pad of paper that I had stolen from the grocery store. And this lady came up and she grabbed my paper and scribbled across it just what Patrick read: having admitted to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic, this is the first step in recovery. And And over the course of a little while after I got a sponsor, I found out what it meant to be an alcoholic. And I wanted to hit that lady when she took my paper. She was like too close, you know what I mean? And she was female, that's bad right there too. And I was working hard and she screwed up my work. I was just mad, which was normal. I was mad all the time. And I sat through that meeting and what I felt was welcomed. And I don't know how come. I mean, people were welcoming to me. They got me coffee and they sat with me and they started feeding me orange juice with big globs of honey in the bottom of it and making me drink it, and it was just like horrific. And I don't know why I wasn't shaking. I wasn't DTing. They just made me drink it. I thought they wanted to torture me. And I stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I left that meeting with a big book. This old timer gave me a big book. Probably 20 or 25 phone numbers in the front of the book of people that I swore to God I would never call if my life depended on it. I just was not going to call them. And I left there. I got in my car. I saw the vodka, and I picked up the phone, and I called that lady that scribbled on my paper. And I told her I had a bottle of vodka in the car, and I was thinking about drinking it. She told me that I should put the phone down and go pour it out. And so I did. I went back. I got on the phone, and I expected a good girl, honey. I'm so proud of you. Come on over. I'm going to give you a bite to eat. We're going to shower you up. You can sleep on my couch. I got you. I'm going to take care of you. So I poured out the vodka, and she goes, good. See you tomorrow at 5:30. And she hung up the phone on me. And I swear to God, I think that witch that I was going to ask to sponsor me in Philadelphia was transplanted to Hawthorne, because she was just like Alice. I did not ask her to sponsor me. What they told me when I was new was that I should get a sponsor, that the men would work with the men and the women would work with the women, and the men would pat your butt and the women would save it. And I thought, pat my butt, save my butt. And I asked this guy named Paul Matson to sponsor me. And he was this 75-year-old, really eclectic, funky, leftover hippie kind of guy. And oh my goodness, I love that man. He had this long gray hair and he wore these bandanas with these black glasses and all this turquoise jewelry, and he spoke with an English accent, even though he was from Inglewood, California. And he was very theatrical, and he would push his glasses down on his nose and he would say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I thought, oh my God, he's like talking right to me. And he would speak, and I would hang on every word he said, knowing that one day I was going to be sober enough to understand him. Because most of what he said just flew right over my head. And I asked him to sponsor me because he was old, because I thought I could work him. He was a man. And I thought he'd give me some money for cigarettes and maybe feed me a little bit and hang out in meetings. I thought if I cried a little bit, he'd lighten up on me because I was a girl. And oh my goodness, I asked him to sponsor me, and for the next 2 years I walked around with a size 11 straight up my butt, like that wonderful old loving man turned to this ogre. And he was so rude, I swear to God. He used to, I would sit in meetings and I would say I was going to share and tell him, my name's Tina and I'm an alcoholic, and he would majestically arise from his seat in the front row and go, that's all you know, sit down now. And I would be like, oh my God, there's like people listening to you, you know what I mean? And you're embarrassing me in front of these people. And I had 30 days sober, and that's a long time. And I got up to take my chip, and I had invited, I swear to God, half of the South Bay to come see me take my 30-day chip, because I'm a miracle. And I show up at this meeting, I get up to the podium, and I'm wearing this funky mini skirt and these really high heels with some fishnets, and I had that flash dance hair going on that came out of here, and I had it going on. And I got up to the podium, I go, my name's Tina, I'm an alcoholic, I'd like to thank you all for these 30 days. And then I was getting ready to explain to you precisely what I did to get those 30 days so you could do what I did and get what I got too. And I swear to God, thank you for this last 30 days. And again, he stood up and he goes, you're finished now. And I like crawled back. Oh my God, he was just rude. And everything that I needed to know about how to live my life in those early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned from him in the most funky ways. Like, I had that 30 days sober, and I went to a midnight meeting so I could celebrate some more, and then I went to the dance, and like he walked in, you guys have sober dances over here, and the disco ball turned into the slow motion thing, And then we went for coffee, and he told me, I was, you know, telling him my sad tale of woe and explaining to him that I was living in my car, and he told me I could store some things at his mother's house, and I thought he meant me, so I moved in. And we stayed together on and off for 2 years, my first 2 years of recovery, and oh my God, we like killed each other. Off again, on again, off again, on again. And I didn't drink. You know, in the States all the time, they say, like, don't have any relationships in your first year. And I can certainly see why that's a good idea, because I didn't do that. But by the same token, like, I didn't drink. It's not a relationship that's going to get me drunk. It's alcohol. And so I stayed close to my sponsor, and I did the things that I was told to do. You know, I used to get up a lot because I couldn't sit still. And I would be dressed just obnoxiously. I had all these dirty clothes, and the Al-Anon women in my home group would give me all of their kids' clothes that were too obnoxious for their daughters to wear, so they'd pawn them off on me. And I would come clippity-clopping into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in way too tight miniskirts and low-cut shirts and high heels, and I'd sit down and I'd get up and I'd run over and get a cup of coffee, and I'd go back and sit down, and then I'd go to the bathroom, and then I'd go talk to you, and then I'd go outside and smoke, and then I'd come sit back down, and then I'd get up again. And one day Paul put his hand on my leg and he pushed it back down, and I sat. And he told me, if you ever get up again, you better have piss dribbling down your leg. And I thought, like, so much for getting up in the middle of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I pretty much just sit still in a chair. Like, not because I think he's watching anymore, but because I was taught when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous how to honor AA. And I love that. That's one of my favorite lessons that I learned from that old man. One day I came in dressed really obnoxious, and he asked me, would you wear that to church? And I told him, why, of course I wouldn't. I think I was going to a dance or something after the Friday night meeting. Well, heck no, I wouldn't. And he said, then I'll be damned if you wear it to mine. And he made me lower my hemline, and he made me raise my neckline, and he made me start dressing appropriately in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a sailor. I had a really foul mouth. I used to like to cuss and shock you with it, which I did because those people were so old. And Paul taught me how to clean up my language when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard not too long ago, I think it was Wayne that said, no one will be offended by your lack of profanity. And I thought, that's kind of profound, you know. He wasn't saying it to me because I don't curse behind the podium. But a lot of other people do in California because they think there's no rules in here. Like the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous pretty much says there's no rules to follow. But oh my God, there's so many rules to follow. You know, they're just those unspoken rules. I learned how to respect AA by cleaning up my language, by dressing appropriately. And Paul taught me how to be of service, and the first thing that he taught me to do to be of service was to get him coffee, white coffee with milk, coffee with milk. And I thought, like, he would go, coffee, and I would think, are your legs broken, old man? Like, get up and get your own, you know what I mean? I failed to see how you, me getting you a cup of coffee is going to keep me sober for the rest of my life. And then I'd say, yes, sir, and I'd go get his coffee. And what I learned was, by serving Paul, I was serving Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was sitting there with about 45 or 60 days sober, and they needed a new ashtray put around her person at the 5:30 meeting, because we used to smoke in our meetings in 84 when I got sober. And I felt my hand levitate because he had my sleeve, and I was the new ashtray put around her person. And I used to show up like 45 minutes early, and I would perfectly space the ashtrays on the long tables, like almost pulling out a yardstick to make sure they were equidistant from the ends, and all of your frail little arms could hit the ashtrays with your cigarettes. And I was the best ashtray putter outer person there ever was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at about 90 days sober, you let me make your coffee, and by this time I was healed and fully recovered. Ask me, I'll tell you. And I didn't want to make your coffee. I thought I should perhaps be your general service representative or secretary of your big meeting on Saturday night. I didn't want to make coffee. And so I made this coffee, and I swore to God you had to serve toothpicks with it, because you just like have grinds in your teeth. You got to chew it because it's chunky. And I'd go, I like that coffee. And those old people would go, that's good coffee, baby. That's Navy coffee. And they'd drink the coffee and smile at me. And You know, I learned that whenever I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I just say yes. And I say yes whether I want to or whether I feel like I need to or I should. A lot of times I say yes whether I think I can or I'm qualified. I just say yes and I show up and I do my best to do what I'm asked to do in AA. And I love this deal. I love the life that I've been given as a result of staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's nothing like coming in here, learning our literature and learning what our history is all about. There's nothing like watching another alcoholic have their lights come on. You know what I mean? Oh my goodness. I love AA. So I stayed sober for a couple years. I got married. I had a couple kids and I went skipping off down that road of happy destiny, and over the next 17 and a half years, I did what I thought I was supposed to do in AA. And I went to shucks a meeting every day. My sponsor told me when I was new, and I asked him how long I had to go to your dumb A&A meetings. He said, every single day for the rest of your pathetic life. And then he died before he could rescind the order. So I've been sober for 24 years and some change, and I still pretty much go to meetings every day. Sometimes two, because I can, and I just love them. And so I was going to meetings, and I had this husband, I had these kids, we bought these houses, and I had these careers, and new cars and all the stuff that I thought was like the goal. You know, like the big, shiny, bright goal, what you're supposed to have when you're doing what you're supposed to do. And what I started doing was I started making all of that outside stuff me on the inside. And I failed to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice. And I hurt my back really bad and 1996. I had a back surgery. I've got nerve damage in my leg, and I found myself laying on my couch, having lost everything. Like the house was gone, the car was gone, I'm bankrupting, trying to find something to rent. And I'm like, God, why me? Pissed, right? And people used to tell me, why not? It's just your turn. And I was so angry. And I realized as I came out the other side of that, like everything that mattered to me, my family and my sobriety were intact, and all the rest of it could go, and it wouldn't really matter. And it went, and then it all came back, which is good. Probably like tenfold it all came back. And at about 21 years sober, I was watching it start to circle the drain again. And my ex-husband had decided to prospect for the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. And I was like jumping on my Harley Davidson, riding along with him, thinking like, if I just go with him, it'll all be okay, right? I could do this. I could do this. And so I'm off doing this, and my oldest son took off. He was in the Navy, went to Iraq, and my youngest son's starting to fail all of his classes in school. He's starting to use drugs, and I'm devastated. I'm trying to hang on for all I'm worth because stuff's breaking, and I'm going to fix it. I am the epitome of, like the big book talks about, self-reliant, self-sufficient, and I think if I could just redouble my efforts, I could fix everything. And one day I realized, like, what I wanted was a sober, sane, spiritual lifestyle. And what I was doing had nothing to do with sober, sane, and spiritual. And so I stopped going along with him, and I hunkered down at home, and I paid attention to my youngest son, and my ex-husband left. And I went into one of those depressions. You know, in step 11, in the 12 and 12, it talks about sometimes we feel the hand of God is heavy and sometimes unjust. And I thought at that time, like, God's hand was heavy and completely unjust. And I was doing everything I knew how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when the stuff hits the fan for me, what I do is I go to three or four meetings every single day. And I start working with more newcomers. And I think if I read one more page, I work one more step, I grab one more sponsee, I go to one more meeting, I take one more person through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I just dive in, everything's going to be okay. And oh my God, I was frantic doing the activity, like I was so busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the same time, I'm running all over Northern California, and I'm speaking, and I'm trying to like act like everything's okay, and it's falling apart. And I don't want to acknowledge the fact that it's falling apart, because then I would have to acknowledge the fact that it's falling apart. So I just hung on for all I was worth, and my ex left, and I went into this depression that I couldn't pull myself out of. And today what I know is, like, depression is like so clinical, and what I was feeling was so self-pity-ish. It wasn't depression, but I had nobody left in my life that was willing to tell me, oh my God, you're feeling sorry for yourself. And I got like 30 sponsees, and they're coming over, and I am like, I swear to God, this is a crucifix, and I'm coming after Dracula with it, and you're getting this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you want it or not, sit down. And I swear I kind of chained them up in my living room to keep them sober, and I had all these sponsees that worshipped me. When I was 20 years sober, I used to float into meetings of AA like 6 inches off the ground because I was levitating, and my favorite were candle lights because you'd turn the lights off and I would glow in the dark. I was just so super sober and spiritual, I made myself sick. And you know, Wayne says, you're really something, and then sometimes he tells me, you're really something else, and I was really something else. At this time, he likened me to like super sober Sybil, you know what I mean? I was just out of my mind. But at 20 years sober, I was so in love with the life that I had single-handedly manufactured for myself in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I had everything that I wanted. And it all fell apart, and at 21 and a half years sober, I was doing all of that frantic activity, doing everything that I knew how to do, and I went over to the MBAR convention to meet with my sponsor one Saturday afternoon, and I was like this crying mess, and I told him, blah, and he goes, go pray about it, honey, and I left the MBAR convention, and I went for a walk, and I found myself on a bridge overlooking the Pacific Coast Highway, thinking like, maybe that's the easier, softer way. Like, I don't want to feel like this anymore. I didn't get sober to feel like this. There's something wrong. And what I thought was that I was doing something wrong. And the truth of the matter is that everything that I had done up until that moment that I was on that bridge enabled me to walk away from that bridge. That's all I know. Every step I worked, every newcomer that I worked with, every sponsor that I had, every page that I read, everything that I had done enabled me to walk away from that bridge. And I had spoken in a meeting up in San Jose, Second Tradition, and there's probably 300 or 400 people that go to that meeting, and I was quite the queen bee, and I would come in, and everybody would go, oh, Tina, and I'd, like, be all happy with myself, and... And so I walked in. I swear I was not going to go to this meeting this day. It was like a couple weeks after I had met with Bill, and I was standing on that bridge, and I was laying on my floor, and I had absolutely hit the bottom. And there was nowhere I could go. I was not going to the meeting. I was a crying, snotty mess. I was just laying in a big old puddle. And I got up and I got dressed and I went to the meeting, because that's one of the things Paul taught me how to do, was just suit up and show up whether you feel like it or not. Happy, mad, sad, or glad, just go to AA, bring yourself. And so I'm like going, I'm not going to the meeting, and I'm putting my clothes on. And I drove up there, it's like an hour from my house, and I walked in and I'm like trying to hold it together, and this newcomer comes up like is characteristic at Second Tradition. They go, Tina, how are you? And I'm like, what? Not what I do. I look good at all costs, trust me. Or I do my best to anyway. And Sean had no idea what to do with me, so he took me up to the front of the room and he threw me at the speaker, who happened to be Wayne. And oh my God, the poor guy, he goes, how are you? And I did the same thing, like, my husband left and I was just like a mess. And he's thinking, why did this kid bring this newcomer up here and throw her at me? So we were talking, and he didn't know what to do, make me quit crying, I guess. So he like swirled me around and danced with me for a minute, and he said something that made me laugh, and then I went off and I sat down in my seat. And what I heard that night was the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, that pure, unadulterated, not watered down AA message that speaks to you right here. Like, I have no idea what I heard here, but I know what I heard here the night that he spoke. And what I realized by the time he was done and that meeting was over was that Alcoholics Anonymous will work for this too. Like, I know because I've memorized this thing front to back, and I could cut you to ribbons with it and you won't know you're bleeding for an hour. I mean, I'm good. And And what I realized is I know in there it tells me that Alcoholics Anonymous will solve all my problems, but I believed that I was in a place where I didn't think it was going to work for this, just for a minute, which landed me on the top of a bridge. And I got to tell you how grandiose an alcoholic is. The bridge was like maybe as high as the ceiling, so I could have jumped off. It wouldn't even have like broke my ankles or anything dramatic. It was just like it would have been a little hop off the ledge. But I was timing my jump to make sure the truck came and finished, you know, stupid. And so I heard him share, and I realized for a minute that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be able to get me through this one too. And it's proven to do that, you know. What I know at that period in my life was it was right around 21 and a half years sober, and I thought I was the queen bee of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so did everybody else. Just ask them, they would have told you. And I thought I was doing absolutely everything perfectly. And what I did was I went through the steps with my sponsor, I made my amends, I did my inventory 6 and 7, I made my amends, and I thought those promises that come on page 86 and 87 of our big book were so phenomenal that I would just hang out right there for a little while. And 20 years later... not really doing steps 10, 11, and 12 every single day the way they're outlined in the big book and the 12 and 12, like I raised my life. I burn it to the ground, and all through self-will and self-sufficiency and self-reliance. And there was nobody in my life that could have told me that I was not doing it right, because I really thought I had it right. And it wasn't until I hit that bottom emotionally at 21 years sober that I realized I needed to try something different. And so Wayne spoke, and I went through the little stupid gratitude line like I was taught. Thank you for coming and speaking. And I said something cheesy, and he asked for my phone number. He gave me his, and can I tell him what he said? He goes, actually, this is going to make me the biggest cat in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd like to give you my phone number, and if you're of a mind to when you're through this, I'd love it if you'd give me a call. And what I said was, here's my number, you call me tomorrow. Because, you know. And he did, and he called me right before my home group the next night, and we started talking for hours every single day. We lived 5 hours apart. He was in Los Angeles, and I'm in Hollister, and we spoke for like 6, 8, 10, 12 hours every single day on the phone, just talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not asking each other inappropriate questions, not trying to dig, trying to find out the dirt to see whether or not I want to waste time investing, whatever. We just talked, and we got to know each other, and we started dating, and Thanksgiving of last year, he asked me to marry him, and we were on the top of the Ferris wheel on the Santa Monica Pier, and he gave me a really great ring and asked me to be his wife. And you know, I've been married for 17 and a half years. I thought, poor you, I thought I knew how to do relationships, and because I was married forever. So I took all of these old ideas that I had about my marriage and how to be in a committed relationship, and I brought them all into this relationship, and I threw them all at him, and he was like, ah! Because they weren't good ideas. And a lot of them just were not good ideas. What I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is no matter how long I stay sober, I get to continually challenge those old ideas that I hold, those ones that don't work for me anymore. And for years in AA, what I did was I looked at that old idea, because it says we have to be rid of them, absolutely. I look at the old idea and I think, well, maybe if I just tweak it a little bit, I can have it work over here still, because I don't want to give them up. I like my old ideas until they hurt so much I don't like them anymore. And so, you know, what I find is the longer that I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh my God, I'm as enamored with our program today as I have ever been. I am more enthusiastic and excited about being sober and being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous than ever. I love the steel. It is the absolute number one thing in my life. Chuck Chamberlain used to say, if sobriety isn't your number one priority, you can't have it. And if it doesn't remain your number one priority, you can't keep it. And as a result of staying in here with you guys and doing the things that I know how to do, that I'm required to do, that I must do, that I have to do, I get to stay sober for one more day. You know, I'm in awe of my life today. Like, Never in my wildest dreams would I imagine that I would be able to come over here to Scotland. We've been over here. We went to the little number three group in Dundee yesterday at noon and went to a meeting. We were at one the day before over at the cathedral by our hotel. And we're driving all over your country. We just spent some time in London with some people that I love, that are friends of mine, that are an integral part of my life today. And, you know, my life consisted of a 71 mg midget in a 3-mile square area. And my life today in Alcoholics Anonymous is huge. You know, it is absolutely huge. And Paul used to tell me that if I stayed sober, that I could have anything that I wanted to have, I could do anything that I wanted to do, and I could become anything that I wanted to become in Alcoholics Anonymous with you guys. And today what I know, in California a lot they say don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Do you guys hear that over here? And I had this old-timer who passed away not too long ago. Her name was Maria. And so we were doing the little smarmy, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, telling it to a newcomer. And Maria looked at me and she goes, you know what, honey, don't leave 5 minutes after the miracle happens either. And I thought, like, how profound is that? Because for years, I thought, like, me sober was the miracle. I really did. If you knew me and where I came from, I'm a miracle. And in California, we all think we're just miracles. We're special, pretty little miracles, and everybody's a miracle. And we were in Akron last year, and we were at the Cyberling Estate Gatehouse, and we were standing like right outside the room where Bill was 12-stepping Dr. Bob. And I got goosebumps, and we went outside, and I got this sweatshirt because I like to buy sweatshirts when I go places. And it says, it was here that the miracle really happened. And I thought, like, oh my goodness, Alcoholics Anonymous is the miracle. You know, here I go. Gosh, 30-some years before I was born, this God-inspired meeting took place that had the capability, the ability to save my life 30, 40, 50 years later, you know. We're going to be at the International Convention next year in San Antonio, Texas. And people are coming from all over the planet to honor Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, where else do you get a life like I have today? But here, it's only through you guys. It's only by the actions that I take. I used to think, I'm going to steal what we've been talking about for a minute. I used to think that absolutely all the answers that I needed for life were contained in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you that every day. And I used to say, if you got a problem, if you just open this book up and read it, on every single page, there's an answer. And I think that answer is kind of like a recipe for a chocolate cake. I heard a speaker one time say that they called their sponsor and they asked their sponsor, they told them they had a problem, and the sponsor said, get a recipe for chocolate cake and read it. So he called the sponsor back. His sponsor told him, great, read it every single day for 30 days, memorize it, call me back. So he called his sponsor back. He goes, tell me the recipe. The kid recited the recipe verbatim, and the sponsor said, great, now cut me a piece of that cake. Like, the directions for my life are contained in the big book in the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. But unless I do what it says in here, I don't get the results that are our results to have if we follow through in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm out. I'm done. And I really want to thank you guys for having us over here this evening. It's been an honor and a privilege to be here. And thank you so much.